Continuing the section on the nuns' training, the métiers of Nonvapong, this section is called Governance. Although he delegated the daily administration of the Mechi section to the senior Mechis, Longpo's presence was felt strongly by everyone. The mere words, "I will put the matter to Longpo," uttered by one of the senior Mechis, was powerful enough to dissolve all but the most intractable problems. Mechi Bunyu, looking back in the late 1980s, said that the serious conflicts in the community were rare, but when something did arise, it was always a great comfort to her to know that, if the matter could not be resolved, Longpo would be there to help her. So this is Mechi Bunyu speaking. Longpo said to me, "If things get too much for the senior Mechis, if people are being difficult and stubborn, then you can come and ask for my assistance." We senior Mechis acted like elder sisters, looking after their younger siblings. If someone deviated from the way of practice laid down in the regulations, or from our instructions, we would admonish them. If they still didn't mend their ways after two or three warnings, then we would have to inform Longpo, who we relied upon as our patron and protector. And so we managed. Otherwise, we wouldn't have survived. I wasn't the only one in charge. Senior Mechi, quote-unquote, is just what people call me. I never had absolute power. I'm not a dictator or anything like that. We have a committee of four or five Mechis, and if someone is behaving badly, then it's a matter to be discussed by the whole committee. At that time, before Lumpur's illness, if we all agreed, then the matter would be taken to Lumpur. He wouldn't immediately accept our side of the story, though. He would conduct his own investigations. When Longpo came, he wouldn't just lay down the law or take anyone's side. He would usually give a Dhamma talk in a relaxed and natural manner on a subject unconnected to the problem of the difficult nun. After he'd finished, he would drink some water and then discuss various bits of business in his easygoing way. Then, out of the blue, he'd say, "Oh, Mechi so-and-so, how are you? How is your practice? Don't go giving headaches to the senior Mechis, will you?" Generally, he spoke in a way that, quote, "neither bruised the lotus nor muddied the water," unquote. So that would be a familiar phrase in Northeast Thailand, or maybe all of Thailand. So if you're going in, lotuses grow in the water, so you have to go into the water to pick them. But they're very delicate, the stems are very easily broken and crushed and can be crushed. So that neither bruising the lotus, so you're careful with picking the flower, and you also you don't stir up the water that you're wading in. So neither bruising the lotus nor muddying the water is a way of doing what's necessary, but taking care while you do it. Whether they were right or wrong, he wouldn't hurt people's feelings needlessly. But sometimes he would have to speak directly in order for people to recognize their mistakes, so that they would become more aware and amend their behavior in the future. But as Mechi Bunyu recalled, when Longpo was stern, it would have a considerable impact. And again, this is Mechi Bunyu speaking. "Anyone of a sensitive disposition would be still feeling it for two or three days afterwards, even if they hadn't been the one told off." And that's also, I should mention, that's a very classical classical method. So if I have to say something that is because of Anagarikar Sutisa's behavior, then I might be looking at Anagarikar Kyun Kyung or Caroline and saying, you know, really the conduct in the kitchen really needs to be tightened up quite considerably, deliberately not looking at the person for whom the teaching is directed. So exactly the same on the men's side. So if I need to correct Venerable Aneja about something, I might be looking at Venerable Titankaro and saying, you know, tall monks really need to be very attentive about the fact that not everyone can reach the top shelves like they can. So then the person who has, see, it's a standard way of putting across feedback, so that then the person who for whom it is intended at least feels, phew, you know, I dodged the bullet there, or you know, or I get the message, but at least he wasn't naming me or shaming me. So it's a way of both getting the necessary message across but not embarrassing somebody in public. Because in the Thai culture, being publicly shamed, so being being sort of called out and named and shamed in a very public way is the worst kind of experience. So there was this standard way of deliberately not looking at the person who's the one responsible for the admonishment.
Ajahn, what if the person is not sensitive?
Then they do it again. Well, then they do it again, and then eventually they kind of have a face-to-face and say, look, you need to change your ways. So you keep adjusting, and that's very much in accordance with the Vinaya principles. You'd have a sort of an informal exhortation, an informal admonishment, and then a formal admonishment, three times, and then you have a formal admonishment three times, and if the person doesn't change their behavior, then you have a kind of a full-on sort of Sangha meeting and a Sangha act, an act of censure. And if they still don't change, then you have an act of suspension. And if they still don't change, then you have an act of banishment. So you have to go through and each one of those is done three times. I've never been in a situation where that's happened in a formal way, but this has got four layers of three, pieces of feedback. And so if by the time you get to the third iteration of the act of banishment, you realize this person is completely impossible, so he's got to go live somewhere else. So you work it according to individual situations. Some people are amazingly it's really when you say, this is wonderful, this is marvelous, this is amazing, how someone can be completely unaware of the fact they're annoying everybody around them. I think, that's amazing, he hasn't got a clue. Everyone else is really upset, and he's quite cheerfully carrying on and not really registering that what they're doing or the way they're doing things is really upsetting or out of place. So it does happen from time to time where you have to give stronger and stronger feedback until, as with the Buddha's principles in the Vinaya discipline and Lumpu Cha in our monasteries, you keep trying to give feedback and give people a chance to change their ways, but eventually there'll be a certain point where you say, the car is coming at 4 o'clock, please have your things ready. That's pretty rare. I've only known that to happen about twice in the last 30 years, 40 years. So it does happen once in a while.
May I just ask, that this is very interesting because I've noticed that method of admonishment quite a lot, and frankly I find it really irritating. So it comes from the Thai tradition?
Yes, yeah.
And it seemed to be less oppositional to do that, to scold in the group, than just to quietly take that actual person aside. And
yes, yes.
Because that doesn't match my cultural heritage, I don't think.
Yeah, that's the very much the standard way of doing it in Thailand.
Well, it does clarify one thing, because I did think one of the nuns was a bit crazy when she'd look at one person fixedly when she was clearly talking about another, but now I know why. Yeah.
There's a method in the madness. So you have to talk to some Thai people about the kind of being confronted is it's almost like a physical attack, and so that if someone is sort of confronted face on, that they are they either have to sort of run away, or they will physically attack. It's held in a whole different way culturally than in the West, and I think probably in the Northeast, where the whole way that village and the way that Lumpu Cha established sort of discussion and decision making was very much in accord with the Northeast Thai manner of decision making in villages. You'd have a sort of a council of elders who were sort of in the middle and everyone else is gathered around, and the sort of subject would sort of roll around the group for a considerable amount of time and sort of be kind of visited in various different ways, and anybody and everybody could chime in at any point. But the senior people would sort of be in the middle, and we would technically be the elders that are supposed to be guiding the decision. But the thing would roll around the whole group, and that everyone would have an opportunity to say what they wanted. And then eventually, when people felt they'd talked enough, then there would be a sort of, so have we decided then? And then people would say, yeah, okay, so we'll build it over there. You know, and so that the decision-making was, it both had an element of respecting seniority, but also an element of people being able to join in with it. But it also can be extremely vague, like, how did that get decided? What, was there a vote? Did I miss something? So for the Westerners sitting in on those meetings, it can be quite strange to think, well, where is this going? Or how's this being tracked about what the discussion is? But it's very much the Northeastern way of doing things. So the Sangha meetings that they have twice a year at Wat Bopong, you have about 500 monks in the hall and an open mic. But it generally devolves to a few ajahns who are very fond of the mic. But anybody can chime in, and the whole thing is over the PA, so any person in the monastery can hear the whole discussion. So it's like it affects everyone, so that they deliberately broadcast the meeting out over the whole monastery. So sometimes some of the venerables have to be reminded, Ajahn, yeah, Lumpo, this is going out over the PA, so you know you might want to calm things, be cautious about what you're saying. But I feel it's also skillful in that way, that there's a sort of shared quality in the decision making. It's not just an authoritarian system, and so that Lumpo Cha was very keen to sustain that way of making decisions communally, rather than just him as the one person dictating. And then that easily becomes the way with a very highly respected or senior ajahn. It can be like, oh God, la te lumpo, whatever the ajahn wants, but he very deliberately brought other people into the mix. And then what Meichi Bunyu says here, that he wouldn't immediately accept our side of the story. So what often happens, I've seen Lumpo Sumato do this quite a number of times over the years at Chithurst and here at Amravati. And so what would happen was he'd be away for some time, and then some issue would rise up in the community, and there would be like, this problem with Ajahn Dhammananda. So, excuse me if we use you as an example here. But so everyone thought, oh, Ajahn Dhammananda, he's really out of order because of this and this. So then it sort of revolves around, and then the group, quote unquote, then develops a particular view and say, this really awful thing has happened, and Ajahn Dhammananda's really out of whack because of this and this. So we'll have to tell Lumpo when he gets back. And so what would happen would be that Lumpo would come back, and he would, a few of the Sangha members would come and tell him, and he'd go, and he wouldn't support what you were saying, and then he'd probably take time to go and talk to to Ajahn Dhammananda and say, so, how are you? And then often he'd hear the other side of the story. And in exactly the same way, he would listen, take it all in. And more often than not, what would be pointed to was, and I think in one of the earlier readings about Lumpo Cha, it was saying how, and they were criticizing the very garrulous, or the outspoken monk, you know, he said, you shouldn't make a big fuss out of small matters. And so it almost, most of the times that I saw this happen with Lumpo Sumato, he would scold the Sangha for kind of forming a clique and ganging up against one poor innocent person like Ajahn Dhammananda. You shouldn't get so upset, you shouldn't be so creating cliques and criticism and getting all sort of fired up over these things. That this is not the way for the Sangha to operate. So the few times I can think that actually happened, I don't think there was a single time he actually supported the view of the prosecution. But it was almost always the looking at the community dynamics and saying, you know, are you aware of what you're doing, and that have you seen how you've been making this divisiveness and blaming this person in this way, you know, even though their behavior might be really out of order. And one time I remember it was a novice who was had been behaving in a very unusual ways while Lumpur Sumedho was away, and so when he came back, then there was a whole string of people went to see him, and they were, none of them were calling him venerable or samaner, or they were just using his name without any kind of honorific or any kind of form of address, just sort of this person. And so when we had this next Sangha meeting, it became clear that Lumpur Sumedho, he was using venerable every time he mentioned his name, very clearly, so that the prosecutors, the prosecuting committee, if they had their wits about them, would realize, aha, he's very pointedly using the word venerable to refer to this person over and over and over again. So, and then that was exactly what he did. He scolded the group for kind of ganging up against that person and not seeing that they were being very judgmental and divisive. It didn't mean he agreed with all that person's behavior or was supporting it, but he was saying, you know, the more important thing is the community dynamics and the way that people are sort of relating to each other, and how easy it is to sort of pick on one person who's the problem. And one of the reasons why Lumpur Sumedho, I think, was particularly sensitive to that, because he'd been a prosecutor in the past himself, had done exactly that with another very eccentric bhikkhu in earlier times at Wapapong. And when Lumpur Cha was away, then the young Ajahn Sumedho had taken the opportunity at the fortnightly recitation to do a confrontation with this particular monk, which was really unheard of. So that at the end of the fortnightly recitation of the monastic rule, then usually the senior monk says, is there any business to discuss? And Lumpur Cha was away, and so then the young Ajahn Sumedho, who was a junior bhikkhu at that point, said, well, yes, there's something I'd like to bring up. And then he had this whole list of wrongdoings of this particular monk, not the other one, there's a different loud monk, and say how his speech was very inappropriate, he was very noisy, he was upsetting to the other monastics, to the lay people, he was very loud, he used bad language, and this was really inappropriate. And the monk is sitting right there, and he's naming him in front of the whole group in a formal meeting. So in terms of Thai etiquette, that was really very, very out of order. But being a righteously indignant American, he was finally someone saying what needs to be said here, you know, kind of giving this person the straight scoop. And then that monk was looking at the floor all throughout the meeting, and Lumpur Liam, who was the senior monk, said, oh, well, yeah, thank you, we hear what you're saying, Tan Sumedho, and then Lumpur should be back in a couple of weeks, and so we'll bring it to his attention. And what happened was that that monk who Lumpur Sumedho had scolded sort of was really embarrassed and shattered, and then disappeared the next day and just sort of took leave and left Wapapong. And so a few weeks later, a couple of weeks later, when Lumpur Cha came back, and probably many of you are familiar with this story, he heard, even though Ajahn Sumedho at the time thought, well, yeah, it was pretty good, I kind of said what needed to be said at last, and then he heard that this monk had sort of scooted off and left, so, oh, well, too bad, but, well, you know, his behavior was really, really off, and so it's probably better for the monastery that he's not here. No one brought it up or made anything of it, and then Lumpur Cha came back and sort of chose a quiet moment and thought, and then said to Ajahn Sumedho, you know, Sumedho, what you said to that monk at the Patimokkha meeting, said that was really out of place. He said, you might have thought that I hadn't noticed, or I wasn't doing anything or saying anything, but do you really think I wasn't aware that his speech was so out of order? Do you really think I wasn't conscious of that? Or I wasn't attentive to that. He said he had annoyed the Sangha in every other monastery he'd been at. He'd been kicked out of every other place. Wat Bopong was the last place he could stay because I made space for him because he was so annoying and upsetting to people. But he could stay here. Now he can't stay here because what you said and you shamed him in public. So he can't stay here. You know, you closed the door on him. So that's poorly done on your part, Sumedho. So you have to accept that. And then he made this comment, you know, you were right in fact, but wrong in Dhamma. So yeah, he did say all the things that he said, and he had acted in those ways. Your facts were correct, but the way you addressed it and the way you brought it up and shamed him with that, then that was wrong in Dhamma. It was not going to be helpful. And so that had a very profound impact on Lumpur Sumedho, and he sort of put his righteous indignation into a context, so that I agreed. Sometimes it can be a bit oblique, so some people don't get the point. But also, you have to cater things in terms of what is bearable or what can be received by a person. And so that Lumpur Cha was doing what he could to help that. That monk kind of break free of his unskillful verbal habits, but he had not taken into account that the young Sumedho would jump in and make his feelings felt. It was a very, very powerful and helpful teaching for Lumpur Sumedho, and I think that's something that. Particularly when the mind is going towards righteous indignation, you know you're right. You've got that this person shouldn't be this way. They shouldn't be doing that. They shouldn't be like this. You can be right in your facts. You can have the correct facts, but you can be wrong in terms of how you're expressing that, or how you're putting that across, or how you're acting on that. So to be right in fact and right in Dhamma is the ideal. So to continue. Again, this is Mechi Bunyu speaking. Everybody was afraid of him. Of course, it wasn't as if Lumpur ever hit anybody, or even used harsh words. But I only had to mention his name, and disputes would fizzle out. If Lumpur was due to give a talk in the Mechi section, while there was a problem going on with one of the Mechis, that nun would assume that I'd told Lumpur all about it beforehand. Her head would ache, and she'd feel like she needed to go to the toilet. It's hard to say why the reaction would be as severe as that, but it was. Lumpur would be very calm, and his discourse would be mildly spoken, but who knows why? The Mechi would be terrified. And yet, if you were to ask any of the Mechis privately what they felt about him, they'd all say that Lumpur was wonderful, and that there was no place like Wat Bopong. You see? It's too subtle to put your finger on. To me, the way he ran the Mechi section was a marvel. And the next section is called Venerable Father, and the first part is called Gruff. That's the sort of or du is the Thai word for being kind of stern or fierce, gruff. Mechi Bunyu recalled how Lumpur could be especially gruff when Mechis asked permission to visit their family. He would say, "What for? Are you homesick? How long have you been here now? The Buddha never visited his home the whole time he was searching for enlightenment. You've only just ordained, and you want to go there already." If he gave permission, he'd say, "Go empty-handed, come back empty-handed. Don't carry a basket full there and a basket full back." On the nun's return, he would ask her, "How was it? The same way you left it? Did you bring a basket full back with you?" He was talking Dhamma language. He meant memories and attachments. If the nun didn't understand, she'd say, "Oh, just a few onions and some garlic, Lumpur." Sometimes he'd ask one of the older Mechis, "How many times did you go home last night?" Meaning, how often did her mind go? If the nun didn't understand, she'd say, "She hadn't been at all." And he'd reply, "You just didn't see it go. You just didn't see your mind go off there." Ajahn Jan often acted as Lumpur's attendant on his visits to the Mechi section. This is Lumpur Jan speaking. Lungpo was especially careful in his relations with women. Although he'd never had the experience of running a household, he ran the monastery in an exemplary way. There were never any scandals. There were no serious disputes. He was always on his guard. Whether through action or speech, he never gave any of the Mechis the opportunity to become close to him by any means whatsoever. Lungpo upheld the 8 Garu Dhammas. When he spoke to a nun, he didn't look at her face, and he never indulged in worldly, flirtatious speech that might have led to her to lose respect. More than any other group of his disciples, the Mechis tended to hold Lungpo in awe. The monks felt this awe too, and many felt it strongly, but their daily contact with Lungpo and their status as fellow monks gave it a more nuanced character. The lay disciples also felt the awe, but it was felt more intermittently, as the greater part of their daily lives was bound up with family and work. For the Mechis, Lungpo was the reason for the life they led. They looked to him as their father, their teacher, their benefactor. They saw him rarely, and then only on formal occasions, but they felt his presence everywhere. Most, moreover, took it for granted that he knew, through his psychic powers, everything that went on in their lives and minds, although they admitted wryly that, being human, this belief did not stop negative emotions flooding through them from time to time. Although Lungpo was supportive in times of genuine crisis, he was also careful to avoid appearing too easily available when problems arose that he wanted them to learn to deal with themselves. Ajahn Jun recalled that one day, while a nun was practicing walking meditation, she had an extremely realistic of a huge snake wrapping itself around her body. Unsurprisingly, she fainted. A fellow Mechi, discovering her lying prostrate on the walking path, called for help. More Mechis rushed forward, and as the reviving nun blurted out the story of the monster snake, a minor panic ensued. Two of the senior Mechis rushed over to Lungpo's kuti to request his assistance. The nun was very distressed. Would he please come and see her straight away? Without expressing the slightest concern, Lungpo said, "Maybe she's already dead. Look after her for now, and I'll come over later on." Many hours after the incident, when the excitement had died down, he paid his visit. So the next section is called Kindness at a Distance. Lungpo had seen monasteries consumed by sexual scandals. He was determined to prevent the same thing happening at Wat Bapong. The strict segregation of the monks and Mechis he insisted upon was based on his understanding of how the most innocent of relationships could, in an unguarded moment, and against all the better judgment of either side, develop into something more serious. His solution was, figuratively, to keep everyone well away from the edge of the cliff. So it's a cliff is a steep drop, so that if you get to the edge, you can easily fall off the edge of the cliff. So this is the standard of conduct in the arrangements of the communities was so that people would not get into the situation where they would have that kind of close personal contact or those kind of more emotionally charged relationships could develop. Although the policy of separation meant that the Mechis saw little of Lungpo, and they would undoubtedly have appreciated seeing more of him, they did not expect it. They had little sense of entitlement, having grown up in a world in which separation between monks and women, whether lay or ordained, was a given. Generally, the only time the Mechis would enter the main area of the monastery was early in the morning, while the monks were on their arms round. The Mechis, eyes downcast, would walk through the forest to the kitchen where they'd helped to prepare food. As soon as the meal was over, they'd return to the Mechi section. If for some reason Mechis would meet a monk on the path, monastic etiquette required them to squat down with their hands in anjali and to look studiously at the ground until the monk, also studiously looking elsewhere, had passed. The absence of even a hint of sexual scandal at Wat Bapong over the years did much to consolidate its good reputation. But newly arrived monks like Ajahn Jun could experience something akin to a culture shock. Again, this is Ajahn Jun speaking. And he'd been a family man before he was monastic life, so he was someone who'd been married and been living in a village in a family situation before his monastic life began. "When I first came to live at Wat Bapong, I did not know the customs and conventions. I passed a group of Mechis and greeted them loudly, 'Hello there! what are you all up to? Lumpur Jan was also a very kind of friendly, outgoing character. He's covered in tattoos, he was a bit of a lad before he was, as they would say in English, he was a bit of one of the boys before he entered the monastic life. So he had a kind of very casual, outgoing character. So, there's any of you who were around in the late 80s? Well, he was here for a year, about 89 or 90. Hello, what are you all up to? The Mayor Cheese looked very shocked and rushed off into the forest. I was baffled. I thought, what is it about forest monasteries? The monks and novices ignore you? Even the Mayor Cheese won't speak to you. Somebody must have told Lung Po that the new monk was doing a lot of improper things, like talking to Mayor Cheese. The next day he explained things to me, and so after that I understood the way that things were done. As time went on, a number of Wat Bapong branch monasteries opened Mayor Chi sections, and these were run on the same principles as the one at Wat Bapong, although much smaller monasteries usually required some relaxation of the segregation policy. To guard against any risk of impropriety, a Sangha regulation was subsequently laid down, restricting the establishment of Mayor Chi sections to those monasteries in which the abbot had spent at least 20 years in the robes. By the beginning of the 1980s, Lumpur's health was in serious decline, and his visits to the Mayor Chi section became more irregular. With his influence waning, problems in the Mayor Chi community began to increase. Some of the Mayor Chis felt a sense of loss and concern for the future. On one occasion, shortly before his illness, he explained to them, and so his illness became most serious during the rains retreat of 1981, and he was staying up at Thamsang Phet Monastery. That's when he had prior to that, he'd been having dizzy spells and blackouts. That's why you always saw him with a walking stick, because he could kind of get dizzy and could fall over easily. But it was in the Vasa, the rains retreat of 1981, that his health really took a dive. So this was shortly before that time. So it's Lumpur speaking here. I stay aloof from everyone, aloof from all the Mayor Chis who come to live here. Everyone is free to speak to me, but I don't speak to everyone. Even so, I feel an inner accord with all of you. It's called dharmic love. It's not a worldly type of love where you have to keep saying nice things to each other all the time, but one in which any problems that arise are discussed in an appropriate way. There are some of you here that I've never spoken to at all. Don't think it's because you are Meichis. These days the monastery is very large, and there are monks and novices that I've never spoken to individually either. It's difficult for one person to oversee such a big community. That's why, as far as possible, it's important that everyone takes responsibility for themselves and their practice. Also, incidentally, Lumpur Jan's monastery had a large Mayor Chi section, and one of the difficulties of him staying here for a year was we got messages fairly regularly through the grapevine that the Mayor Chis were eager for when Lumpur Jan was going to come back, and, so that he would... He would joke about how it was both the sort of his responsibility to have to go back, but also it was very nice to have a break to be here in Amaravati, where he had no responsibilities and couldn't speak the language and was sort of gleefully. He said, "I don't know what's going on. It's great." So he really did, he was one of the most sort of generous and kind and active of Lumpur Cha's disciples, and so. He was very, very popular and much loved, and so having a year here was a sort of huge sigh of relief for him, not to have people crowding around and lots of decision-making and guiding to have to do. Are there any other questions? Okay, the next section is called No Favorites. Lumpur had noted how in other monasteries competition for the teacher's attention amongst the resident Mayor Chis and the monks doesn't say that here, but it's a prominent issue. Competition for the teacher's attention amongst the resident Mayor Chis could lead to jealousies that undermined the harmony of the community. He maintained a strictly impartial stance towards them. Many of the Mayor Chis were especially impressed by how he refrained from singling out his mother for any special attention or privileges. In the culture in which they lived, the willingness to treat one's mother just as one member of a larger group was seen as an unusual achievement. And a footnote there says, a notable exception to this came with the elaborate funeral that Lumpur arranged for Mayor Pim upon her death in 1976, which featured many days of merit-making activities dedicated to her. Yeah, that's a major understatement. They built a papier-mâché mountain. They had this whole kind of basket weaving program. I think the monks wove the bamboo frames for the mountain, and then the nuns gathered all these old newspapers and made papier-mâché. And they literally built this papier-mâché mountain in the middle of Wat Pa Phong, where the Opositor Hall is, the temple is. And so Mayor Pim's body was in her coffin in the middle of the mountain. And you had four entrances. So you had like an entrance and an exit for the women, and an entrance and an exit for the men. So people could file in, pay their respects to Mayor Pim's body, and the whole of this sort of papier-mâché mountain. It was painted with kind of trees and caves and yogis and tigers and kind of wild boar and monkeys, and they had a grand old time. So Lumpur's creative urges they have occasional outlets. And so then her body was kept there for some time while they had this whole sort of merit-making ceremony. And for the day of her funeral, then I think he gave, there was 99 local men were given the Anagarika precepts. I'm not sure how many women were ordained, but the huge numbers of the locals all shaved their heads and took the 8 precepts to make merit for Mayor Pim and for her funeral. And so it was a very, very grand occasion. And then after she was cremated, they just set fire to the whole mountain because it was all paper and bamboo. So that when it came time for the actual cremation, they sort of put the torch to the mountain, and the whole papier-mâché mountain went up in flames with Mayor Pim at the center. So it was quite a dramatic event. And then that's on the place where she was burnt. That's where he built the Opositor Hall. So the temple is built on the spot where his mother was cremated. So not all the nuns got that treatment. She was special in that respect. She got unique treatment in that respect. So this impartiality was not a blanket indifference. On the contrary, as Mechi Bunyu recalled, Lumpur showed a consistent concern for the welfare of every one of the Mechis. And again, this is Mechi Bunyu speaking. The monastery was still quite unknown then, and not many people came to offer food. Usually, the only fruit we'd have would be the small amount that came from the Mechi's garden. One day, a group of lay people came to help work. One day, a group of lay people came to help with the work project. One of them planted a pineapple shoot near the kitchen, and it grew up into a pineapple. Very big it was too, like the ones that nowadays they bring up from the southeast. Pineapples were rare then. Every day, when we went to the kitchen, we'd look at the pineapple and be thinking how big it was becoming, and wondering what Lumpur would have done with it when it was ripe. All of us were looking forward to a taste of it, because we'd never eaten a pineapple before in our lives. Then one day the pineapple disappeared. Oh no! I wailed in my mind. Where's it gone? Mechi Bunyu found out the next morning. The pineapple had appeared in the kitchen, neatly cut into 15 equal pieces, one for each of the 8 monks and 7 Mechis in the monastery. Lumpur was not idealistic about sense restraint. For monastics training themselves to detach from sense pleasures, enjoyment outlives indulgence, and it's supplanted by equanimity through insight, not by acts of will. For almost all the members of a monastic community subsisting on a bare diet, a slice of an exotic fruit is a treat. Lumpur did not condemn it as worldly foolishness, and was content to ensure that everyone in the community, including the Mechis, had an equal share in this treat. It was this kind of consistent but understated consideration, one that belied his forbidding demeanor, that endeared him to the Mechis. Lumpur's concern for the Mechis was clearly apparent to the monks, not least through his regular exhortations on the fair distribution of food. He would remind them to always bear in mind the hard work and sacrifice of the Mechis that made possible the meals they ate, and to make sure that there was always sufficient food sent back to the kitchen. He said that it would be very bad karma if they took so much that those who had prepared the food went without. The emphasis on fairness and impartiality extended to all of the requisites. Mechi Bunyu recalled the distribution of cloth. Lumpur would distribute the cloth himself. After he'd arranged a pile for each nun, the bell would be rung, and the Mechis would go up to the raised platform in order of seniority and take her cloth. Afterwards, we compare the number of pieces, the quality of the cloth, its fineness or coarseness. They would all be exactly the same. So I feel this is an extremely important principle, just like I was saying about requisites being shared out, no one having their private stashes of medicines or cloth, or whether they come from a poor family or rich family. That I feel is one of the most important things for someone in the role of a teacher or a leader, that they don't have favorites, or they don't have sort of people that they spend all their time with, or they take as their friend, or they get close to, and others that they sort of don't notice or push away or don't give attention to. And that also, I should say, that was one of the principles that I inherited from my own parents, that they have three children, myself and my two sisters, and it was always, as we say in the English expression, even Stevens. Everyone got exactly the same. No one got special treatment. And there was no concept of any child being the favorite child or getting more or better than anybody else. It was always absolutely even between the three of us. And I feel in terms of community life, that's a very important principle, not just for the person who's in the leading position, but with each other, to be in a sense of developing the practice to be mindful of that, the habit of creating favorites, or people that you like to be with, or people that you praise, or people that you criticize, or you don't want to be anywhere near, and just to be mindful of that kind of biasing, imbalance of perceptions. Say, okay, well, that person is more appealing, but I don't have to spend all my time with them. Why don't I make the effort to go out for a walk with this monk, or why don't I see if I can lend a hand to that nun? Why can't I? Can I help this person or spend time with that person? And that has a very powerful effect of developing a quality of Dhamma community and spiritual friendship, that you're not using your personal preferences to guide how you spend your time and where you put your attention, but rather you're using the principles of Dhamma and your shared life, your shared intention of going forth. And it's frequently reflected upon that coming to live in a monastery, whether you're a layperson or a monastic, a woman or a man, we end up living with people that we would never have lived with as as lay people, that we would never have sort of quote unquote chosen as friends, and that the range of characters with different personalities, different backgrounds, different languages, different political affiliations and preferences is a huge range, and that the way that you most helpfully or most sort of skillfully function as a Dhamma community is that you put the fact that you've all gone forth, you've all taken refuge in the Triple Gem, and you're all respecting the precepts. That's front center. That's the central principle. And the fact that you might be a fan of Brexit or opposed to Brexit, or you might be an American family or a French family or a Sinhalese family, is all totally secondary to that, the principles of the triple, taking refuge in the Triple Gem, and your intention in going forth for the realization of Nibbana. Those are the things that are the basis for community, and the other things sort of hover around the edges in a secondary role. So the next section is called To Be a Mechi. Women applying to join the Mechi community at Wat Pa Pong were required to undergo a vetting procedure, with senior family members expected to act as sponsors and guarantors of their good character. The most basic criteria for acceptance into the community was that the woman should not be pregnant. and that this was a chief reason why women accepted into the community would be expected to undergo a probationary period as a laywoman. A probationary period was also provided an opportunity for the senior Mechis to observe the applicant's conduct and personality at close quarters and to judge their suitability. The exacting daily schedule and strict regulations played a major role in weeding out the unsuitable candidates. Women applying to join the Mechi community at Wapapong were not expected to make commitments as to the length of time they would remain. Some became Mechis for a limited period, perhaps a month. Some intended to spend the rest of their lives in the monastery and left after a few days. And then there were those that came for a short time and ended up staying for the rest of their lives instead. Most of the Mechis, like the monks, came from peasant farming backgrounds and were used to an active, practical life. They usually found the forest monastic life, in which formal meditation periods alternate with the mindful performance of communal tasks, such as sweeping, cleaning, cooking, and tending the garden, provided a good balance. For those who felt that enlightenment was still far away, accumulating merit through wholesome activities provided a reassuring compensation for the frustrations of meditation. Growing vegetables and preparing food constituted the Mechis' primary contribution to the overall functioning of the monastery. As the number of monks and nuns increased to almost 100, it became a major daily effort. The work was done in noble silence, punctuated only by unavoidable orders or requests. Subtle points of etiquette concerning such matters as the use of pots and the frequency of hand washing helped to keep the nuns grounded in the present moment. Cleanliness was an important object of mindfulness for everyone. The Mechis also contributed to most of the major work projects that took place in the monastery over the years. Perhaps their proudest achievement was the firing of the many thousands of bricks that the monks used to construct the monastery wall. That was actually about 100,000 concrete blocks. So the nuns became quite a kind of an engineering company. So that they cast the concrete blocks and then the monks took them and built the wall. And so that was, and this goes around the whole of about 100 acres of the Wapapong forest, and that, you know, that wall is still there. Also, when Lumpur did the temple building at the centre of Wapapong, and the place where Mepim was cremated, then there was a joint operation. He kept the nuns working party and the monks working party separate. There was this wall that he built up, and so then the nuns would gather the earth, because the temple is built on a big mound, and that mound is all made by people. That was just flat before. So the nuns gathered the earth from their little sort of earth quarry off on the other side of the monastery. And then they would bring the earth in barrows and baskets, and then they'd bring it up to this wall, and then they dumped it over the wall. And then on the other side of the wall, the monks then collected the earth in these little wicker baskets, and then they took it to the building site, and then they kind of pounded it down with their bamboo poles, and that made the mound that the temple sits on. So that, again, the nun's life, it was a... there was, you know, a lot of physical engagement involved in that, and so there was a kind of communal effort and a sort of communal spirit that was gathered around those kind of projects.
Why did they put it on a mound?
Because it's the temple; it's supposed to be up higher than everything else. Also, because it has two huge water tanks underneath. So the water that falls on the roof is then collected in these downpipes and then feeds these two huge water tanks. And so then that would be like the water supply for the monastery during the dry season. That's that's my perception of it, is that a sense of the temple, the Upositor Hall, being the most important building, so it needs to be in a prominent place. But exactly why it was put on the kind of a mound as big as it was, I'm not sure. Why they didn't dig a hole and put the tanks in the ground, I'm not sure. But that was the choice at the time. Okay, any other questions, thoughts? One of the things about cooking that I've mentioned frequently is that the reputation of Wat Pa Phong was that it had the worst food in the world. And I can testify that at least in the 1970s that might well be true. And that whenever the trusty order of Mae Chees started to make things that were a bit more delicious, then a message would go back like, it's getting too tasty. You need to sour it up. We need to sustain the reputation of this horrible food. And no one's coming to Wat Pa Phong for the food. Okay, the last section I'll read today, and then there's a bit more to, in the nuns' thing. We'll finish it tomorrow, but we'll just do one little bit more today. So this last section here is called Tudong. At Wat Pa Phong, the Mae Chees were expected to keep many of the Dutanga ascetic practices incorporated into the monks' training. So like eating one meal a day, eating all of the food that you have out of a single vessel. In their case, their vessel was a white enamel bowl. Every observance day, they abstained from lying down and spent the night meditating. Many of them took on special practices, such as fasting or keeping silent, in order to accelerate their efforts in meditation. Although it was not considered safe or socially acceptable for Mae Chees to go wandering through the countryside on Tudong like the monks, Lumpo did give the more senior nuns opportunities to practice in wild, lonely areas. With the opening of Tham Sang Phet Monastery in 1969 and Wat Kuen the following year. So Wat Kuen, this is a one of the branch monasteries that was developed during Lumpur's lifetime. And it's Kuen means a dam. So it was a big reservoir that they'd built a dam, flooded a valley, and there was about 1,200-acre, 1,500-acre forest on the far side of the lake, and then the head of the provincial governor offered the land with the forest to Lumpur Cha to be a branch monastery. So it's on the kind of peninsula that goes out into the lake, and so that then Lumpur accepted the forest, and then they developed the monastery buildings there, and then you'd have to go on the arms round on a boat across the reservoir to get to the village on the western side. So it's generally known as Wat Kuen, just means the dam monastery. But it was like a very large forest with a lot of wild animals there. With the opening of Tham Sang Phet Monastery in 1969 and Wat Kuen the following year, the Sangha acquired large remote properties where Lumpur would sometimes give permission for groups of Mae Chees to live out in the forest under their glots, which is the umbrella with the mosquito net, and come face to face with their fears of spirits and wild animals. Living under a glot in the forest without the protection afforded by a kuti was a daunting challenge, and only the most mature of the nuns were given this opportunity. On her first such expedition, Mae Chee Jun, one of the senior Mae Chees, recounted with amusement how she'd been terrified throughout the night by the eerie sound of what she was sure was a malevolent spirit. The next day she was the object of some gentle teasing when she found out that what she'd been listening to was, in fact, the plaintive sound of a female civet cat abandoned by her mate. A civet cat is a kind of wild cat, like a lynx, sort of, I mean not like a sort of tiger size, but small, but they were reasonably common in that in northeast Thailand in the bigger forests. But once the Mae Chees had overcome their initial fears of the forest, they found, like the monks, that life under such conditions gave rise to an alertness and enthusiasm for the practice that was profoundly energizing. So, any questions, reflections? Sister Tejasar is teetering on the brink, yes.
Ajahn, I do have a question, but it's relating to yesterday reading.
Mm-hmm.
Beginning that you were, there's a nun approach Ajahn Chah about going to the hospital, and Ajahn Chah has rejected her request. Is it because there's not a hospital available, or is it just that Ajahn Chah won't allow her to go to the hospital?
You know, in the early days, the general standard was that you would try and deal with your illness just by using your meditation and or like with herbal remedies from the forest, and you use endurance. That was the same for the monks and for the nuns. There also, the fact was that Ubon, there was a hospital in Ubon, but it was pretty basic, and so that it might be more dangerous to go to the hospital than to stay in the wat and use the local herbal remedies, so that like, for example, the first week I was in the monastery, I managed to cut a large hole in my foot with a machete. And they took me off to the hospital, Ubon Hospital. This was in 1978. And so then we got to the hospital. Ajahn Jagaro very kindly came along with me. And so then they told him, and I severed all the tendons in my foot, and it was kind of gushing blood all over the place. And so they said, oh, well, it's the weekend, so the doctors will be back on Monday. They can sew him up then. So he knew enough about medicine and injuries to know, no. Because if you cut a tendon, then the muscle just sort of pulls it, sort of, you know, the muscle contracts. And so then you can't get the tendons to join up again later on. So he said, no, you can't leave it till Monday. So they said, okay, well, we'll figure something out. So I was actually sewn up by some medical students. And I woke up during the operation. So they used nitrous oxide to anesthetize me. And so they didn't give me very much. So then I woke up on the operating table and I could feel them sewing up my foot, because there's quite a lot of joining up the bits they had to do. And also, as they were wheeling me into the operating theatre, they had Simon and Garfunkel playing on a tape recorder, The Sound of Silence, interestingly enough. And they looked like teenagers. I mean, they definitely were. And okay. And so, but I was strangely unanxious at that point. And so then, as I said, I woke up on the operating table and they're working on my foot, so... But it was okay, you know, I recovered. But it was a fairly rough experience in the hospital. But by the 70s, they could actually do surgery and had reasonable antiseptics and such things.
Yeah, my point is, I'd like to know, is it Ajahn Chah that wouldn't allow people to go for hospital? He want them to use that as an object of meditation. Because Buddha have teach that not to go to both extreme, not indulging and not asceticism. You need to stay on a moderate. So if not going to see a doctor and you get yourself very ill, which cannot support you in your practice, what I need is a second opinion about because Buddha have laid out that the four requisites that we need is food, shelter, and medicine. Mm-hmm. Which he encouraged people to live in a wise way, so that you're able to support you to grow spiritually. So my point now is, why is Ajahn Chah encouraging the extreme method that getting people to get themselves so ill and they... Yeah, it may be a good kind of object meditation. Likewise, Ajahn, you did mention if you are meditating, your feet, your leg is you watch your leg, if it's pain, you watch it, but if you find that it can be harmful, you need to kind of readjust yourself. So I don't understand why Ajahn is, Ajahn Chah is encouraging this kind of a method.
Well, that was very much the standard that he'd inherited from Lumpu Man, that the, you know, also living off in the forest, you don't have access to a lot of things, and also that along with the Buddha having the medicine as the fourth requisite, then he did teach this method of Dhamma Osata, or using meditation to treat illness. And so like when we do the Bhojanga Purita, which is the purita we do for people who are ill, then it recounts the incident where the various different monks, Moggallana and Chunda and others, were ill, and the Buddha said, well, they should recollect the seven factors of enlightenment. That's the treatment. And then they recover. So that you have both. You have both that using the medical treatment, and the Buddha received medical treatment. Jivaka was his doctor, and so he was happy to receive medical treatment of an ordinary nature from Jivaka, but also he encouraged this the other approach of working with the mind, and so I think with many aspects of Wat Bopong in the early days, there was this sort of, as it was called yesterday, you had take no prisoners attitude, like just super tough. But then that was, say, very appropriate in the early days, but as the community got bigger and also the seeing the results of that, I think, as it was mentioned there, in Yilanpo became a bit more lenient and it's going to be more kind of open to people, say, receiving medical treatment or having a few more comforts, and being able to live in a less sort of physically challenging way. But the inclination, he used that analogy of steering your boat upstream a little bit so the current will carry you down to the spot where you want to get on the other side. It's always to be endeavouring to go against the stream rather than at sort of the first sign of discomfort moving or the first sign of I think I've got something wrong with me, I should go to a doctor. That the first thing was, well, what's your mind doing with this? Or is this really a problem? Or can you work with this just using your mind? So that it's both following the guidance or the example of his teachers, but also developing that quality of paying attention to the mind and seeing what degree the mind can be the main resource. And that's what he did for himself. That's how he practiced for himself and how he dealt with his own illnesses and difficulties.
Yeah, I don't understand that.
Do you understand what I just said?
Yes, I do.
I don't know what else one can add to that. It's just he was encouraging a standard of being ready to work with the mind and not to immediately feel I need a doctor, I need treatment, but to take the mind as the first first thing to bring into focus is, okay, well, what's the mind doing with this, or can this be dealt with just on a mental level? And then and he himself, he had lots of medical treatment towards the end, so it's just developing a kind of inner strength, but we're not being fanatical about it. So that some religious groups like the Christian Scientists, they refuse to have any kind of medical treatment at all. And our neighbor, Sybil, she died because they were Christian Scientists, and that she refused medical treatment. And she could have survived, but she didn't because they refused to go see a doctor. So that I would say that's really extreme. But I think it's not a bad standard to have to be, when you have an ailment or an illness, that not the first thing to do is to call up a doctor or make an appointment, but to say, well, wait a minute. What's going on here? What's my attitude towards this? And to to be looking at the mind and how the mind relates to it as the first thing of concern. Okay. Yeah.
Can we say that Ajahn Chah may reply differently if it's a different person's request? So in the end, it's one of his skillful teaching.
Very likely, because there'd be people that would be eager to go to the hospital, as soon as they've broken a fingernail, and he would just say no, and others who he'd say, Liam, you need to go see a doctor, get in the car. He'd drag them off because he knew they would never. He would see, this person's really ill, and they need help. So exactly, he would adjust his advice or according to who it was that was having that experience of illness. But we should come to a close there, I think. That's enough for today.